Relations are not things, but they are nonetheless real. On the other hand, the things we imagine to be real are actually hidden and dark, except so far as we catch the luminous flicker of thought that runs quickening from the one thing to the other, giving us not only their relations, but the things themselves. There are no things apart from the relations constituting them. The inability to convey meaning directly from one person to another will not seem unduly paradoxical to anyone who has reflected upon the oddity with which we began, the oddity of asking what meaning means. We can't get around the fact that we must already have a capacity for directly accessing what we are inquiring about. The capacity is already implied in the asking, and any individual who would understand must exercise that capacity for himself. When others try to elucidate their meanings for us, they are simply trying to help us wake up more fully, to come to ourselves. Meaning is a fundamental given of the world we live in. If there is anything in the evolutionary literature purporting to explain the origin of speech that doesn't already assume a capacity for speech, I would like to know about it. As Barfield has succinctly fingered the matter, asking about the origin of language is like asking about the origin of origin. We can speak only because we were first spoken, and before we were spoken, the single cell was spoken, bearing in all the narrative details of its molecular adeptness and harmony the reverberating imprint, the resonance of the speaking through which it lives. I will have more to say on this theme below. So no, we don't require a tortuous philosophical analysis of meaning. We need only wake up to the sea of meaning within which we all swim, and without which we would have no world whatever. We live by grace of meaning. Our world is a logos world. To pretend to refuse this meaning is to attempt a self-effacement and a world effacement we can never fully carry out. It is to refuse to stand awake as human beings. Meaning never arises from the non-meaningful. The question we should ask ourselves is not whether meaning can arise from what is not meaningful, but whether not meaningful makes any sense at all, which, of course, is to ask whether meaningless has any meaning. That's the kind of absurd territory we lose ourselves in when we ask for an informative and truthful science without meaning. Organisms of meaning. We saw in my essay, What Do Organisms Mean?, that local, temporary relations of cause and effect in the organism can never be relied upon to repeat themselves from moment to moment. Physical lawfulness is certainly maintained throughout the organism, but no given cause is likely to find itself in exactly the same context or configuration of relations twice in succession, and therefore it is not precisely the same cause and will not produce precisely the same effects. So, we don't witness the kind of reliably repeated causal relationships commonly designed into a machine and through which we understand and explain the machine. Organisms maintain their own being and character amid a continual kaleidoscopic shifting of causal relations. That's what makes them organisms. They seem to be more in charge of the causes than the causes are in charge of them. From inorganic to organic. This implies that we must understand the organism in a different way, and when I spoke of organisms of meaning, this different way is what I had in mind. Certainly, physical causes and effects are already meaningful, which is to say that they are not physical in some mindless sense. Causes and laws are relationships, not physical things. They are idea-like or conceptual, which is why the legislative comparison made sense to Bacon. Two masses obeying the Baconian law of gravity that obtains between them, however you choose to describe the feat, are reliably adhering to certain mathematical relationships, as if those immaterially defined relationships belonged to their nature. At some objective level, the lawfulness is a kind of understanding. So when I speak of organisms of meaning, it's not to deny the meanings we find in the inorganic world. nor is it to descry some exotic, previously unknown physical force to be added to the ones we already know. Rather, the aim is only to acknowledge whatever particular sort of meaning we find in whatever context we're looking at, inorganic or organic. And it is just a fact that we can recognize a very different kind of meaning, one more obviously accessible to us in familiar cognitive terms, when we turn from the inorganic to the living creature. The familiarity is not such a puzzle, considering that we are living creatures ourselves. Here, both in ourselves and in other organisms, we find, in a reversal of the mechanistic view, that causes do not so much explain the organism as they stand in need of explaining by the organism. It's by seeing how the organism is pursuing its own telos ends that we begin to understand its way of continually reshaping causal relations to its own purposes. We certainly must elucidate the moment-by-moment causes and effects, but this is only so that, by recognizing the pattern shifting of causal relations, we can glimpse the meanings, intentional and otherwise, of the organism as a whole. By analogy, in watching a person's physical movements and activities, we can get an idea of the intentions giving rise to those activities. When data overwhelm meaning. A particular way of looking is required for this, a way of looking now threatened by the swollen flood of data tending to overwhelm all efforts at meaningful understanding. In their introduction to The Human Genome at 10, the editors of Nature refer to the mismatch between the rapidly increasing ease of gathering genomic data versus the continuing difficulty of establishing what the genetic elements actually do, a sentiment put in stronger terms by James Collins, a bioengineer at Boston University. Quote, "We've made the mistake of equating the gathering of information with a corresponding increase in insight and understanding." Unquote. Likewise, Nature columnist Philip Ball, citing newer data-gathering projects, such as an expensive initiative to resolve protein structures, counsels restraint. Quote, "Before animal spirits transform this into the next revolution in medicine, it might be wise to ask whether the Human Genome Project has something to tell us about the wisdom of collecting huge quantities of stamps before we know anything about them." Unquote. And mathematical biologist Joshua Plotkin, referring to the discovery of vast regulative processes bearing on DNA, concludes, quote, "Just the sheer existence of these exotic regulators suggests that our understanding about the most basic things, such as how a cell turns on and off, is incredibly naive." Unquote. The insights we seek, as I tried to illustrate in my essay, The Unbearable Wholeness of Beings, have a great deal to do with the way in which almost infinitely complex sub-processes, all of which are subject to every sort of unpredictable perturbation, and nevertheless woven together, coordinated and integrated into an overall coherence we can only attribute to cell, tissue, organ, and organism as a whole, not only at the level where they talk about birds building nests or embryos preparing organisms for future functioning, but even at the molecular level, biologists employ a goal-oriented language of means and ends, a language of intention and agency, a language of sensing and responding, a language of meaningful communication. I will not repeat that earlier exposition here, but will offer a parallel, and with a different emphasis. Everything in the previous paragraph, and everything implied in asking what the elements of a cell are doing, suggests that we're looking at a story, and, in fact, biology is primarily a narrative discipline. Every organism is telling a story. Its meanings are storied meanings. When the stories end, the organism is dead. The primacy of organic narrative. The fact that life is a set of interwoven narratives is so obvious, so in our faces, so implicit in the entire literature of molecular biology, that it manages to go mostly unremarked. This despite its being the single most salient truth about the nature of life. As I was sitting down to write this present text, I was emailed the December 2011 table of contents of Cold Spring Harbor Perspectives in Biology, a journal from one of the leading research laboratories in the world. Here is the first half of one abstract from that journal. Proteome refers collectively to all the proteins expressed in a cell or organism at a particular time. Conserved refers to the preservation of biological features over some span of evolutionary history, which is thought to yield at least a rough measure of the functional importance of these features. Consider the narrative aspects of the biological knowledge being summarized. Quote, maintaining the proteome to preserve the health of an organism in the face of developmental changes, environmental insults, infectious diseases, and the rigors of aging is a formidable task. The challenge is magnified by the inheritance of mutations that render individual proteins subject to misfolding and/or aggregation. Maintenance of the proteome requires the orchestration of protein synthesis, folding, degradation, and trafficking by highly conserved and deeply integrated cellular networks. In humans, no less than 2,000 genes are involved. Stress sensors detect the misfolding and aggregation of proteins in specific organelles and respond by activating stress response signaling pathways. Unquote. There is virtually nothing but story here. The larger story has to do with the overall life trajectory, the development of an organism as it strives to maintain its well-being, its health. It inevitably ages, can become diseased in a way that threatens a premature denouement. But within that story, there is a diverse ensemble of sub-narratives, all being orchestrated into a whole. And so, there are tasks to perform, things that can go well or badly, mistakes and corrections, sensing and responding, and communication in all directions, signaling and trafficking. Even a word such as mutation, in this biological context, implies an expected or normative course of events that has somehow been controverted. And, in an inanimate world without biographies, we would not extend the story across generations by speaking of inheritance. We don't say that crystals inherit each other's form, even when a tiny bit of one crystal seeds another. There are many biologists and philosophers who write off all such storied language, so obviously implying intentions or goals, among other meanings, as harmlessly metaphoric, and not really meant to be taken seriously. The metaphors, they say, could easily be dispensed with, even as the scientific truth was retained. This is more easily said than made any sense of. It's true that words such as regulate, organize, and respond may be, and often are, badly abused, as when they are attributed to particular molecules rather than to contexts and wholes. But such ubiquitous words, fully possessed of their intentional and directive aspects, clearly have places in our understanding of the life of the organism, if only we recognize the contextual, dare I say holistic, character of their cognitive, agent-like meanings. Let the person who dismisses the language of meaning and intention as harmless metaphor offer us a rewording that eliminates meaning and intention without sacrificing the observable reality being described. On getting a meaningful job done. I'd like to provide a few pictures, beyond those in my earlier articles, to suggest something a little more full-bodied and contextual about the kind of meaning we find in organisms. An editor of Science, summarizing the gist of some recent research, writes, quote, if you think air traffic controllers have a tough job guiding planes into major airports or access a crowded continental airspace, consider the challenge facing a human cell trying to position its proteins, unquote. A given cell, he notes, may make more than 10,000 different proteins and typically contains more than a billion protein molecules at any one time. Somehow, a cell must get all its proteins to their correct destinations and, equally important, keep these molecules out of the wrong places. And further, it's almost as if every mRNA, that's an intermediate between a gene and a corresponding protein, coming out of the nucleus knows where it's going. As I've just noted, there's not much sense in saying particular molecules know where they're going, but the context they find themselves in certainly embodies and gives expression to a kind of wisdom that proves highly effective in coordinating their movements. The physical organism is transparent to meaning. Bear in mind that where a molecule in a cell is going is decisive for its function. Some molecules, for example, are outward bound on signaling missions to distant reaches of the body, while others are inward bound on different signaling missions. Some are headed to a particular locus on a highly differentiated cell membrane, while others are targeted for any of a virtually infinite number of possible destinations somewhere in the intricate cellular landscape of tubes, sacs, clumps, strands, and capsules that may be involved in everything from intercellular communication to metabolic efficiency. Further, the billion protein molecules in a cell are virtually all capable of interacting with each other to one degree or another. They're subject to getting misfolded or all balled up with one another. They're critically modified through the attachment or detachment of molecular subunits, often in rapid order, with intermediate implications for changing function, and can wind up inside large capacity transport vehicles, headed in any number of directions. They can be sidetracked by the diverse process of degradation and recycling, and so on without end. Yet the coherence of the whole is maintained. The question is indeed, then, how does the organism meaningfully dispose of all its molecules, getting them to the right places and into the right interactions? The same sort of question can be asked of cells, for example, in the growing embryo, where literal streams of cell are flowing to their appointed places, differentiating themselves into different types as they go, and adjusting themselves to all sorts of unpredictable perturbations, even to the degree of responding appropriately when a lab technician excises a clump of them from one location in a young embryo and puts them in another, where they may proceed to adapt themselves in an entirely different and proper way to the new environment. It is hard to quibble with the immediate impression that form, which is more idea-like than thing-like, is primary, and the material particulars are subsidiary. Two systems biologists, one from the Max Delbruck Center for Molecular Medicine in Germany, and one from Harvard Medical School, frame one part of the problem in this way. Quote, "The human body is formed by trillions of individual cells. These cells work together with remarkable precision, first forming an adult organism out of a single fertilized egg, and then keeping the organism alive and functional for decades. To achieve this precision, one would assume that each individual cell reacts in a reliable, reproducible way to a given input, faithfully executing the required task. However, a growing number of studies investigating cellular processes on the level of singular cells reveal large heterogeneity even among genetically identical cells of the same cell type." Unquote. The question they're asking is how cells can do the right thing, cooperating to form the unthinkably complex architecture of a mammal while dealing with the heterogeneity, the continual fluctuation of their molecular components. There's no determinate mechanical or computational rigidity here, no interaction of the parts of a smoothly running machine. Where is the sequence of reliable causes that can account for the predictable outcome of the process as a whole, when all the causal details are so variable and so obviously being shaped to living purposes? We need to understand all these physical connections. But we get to the living processes only when we raise ourselves above the causal web and view it from a different level of meaning, a level where we can ask, what is going on from the organism's point of view? It's always that way with meaning. The movements of a ballet dancer can be analyzed in terms of the play of force in muscle, bone, and flesh, but we read the movements only when that play becomes effectively transparent to us, only when we look through it to another level of meaning. This is the kind of thing that biologists will always notice themselves doing, if only they observe themselves. A form of knowing. I spoke a moment ago of molecular and cellular movements that seem to be both meaningfully directed and unprogrammed. Here is a more concrete example. It deals with the fiendishly complex and coordinated response to a challenge, a wound, that is always unique in its countless details. That is, the organism is facing something that neither it nor its ancestors have ever faced before in just this way. The description is offered by English biologist Brian Ford. Surgery is war. It is impossible to envisage the sheer complexity of what happens within a surgical wound. It is a microscopical scene of devastation. Muscle cells have been crudely crushed, nerves ripped asunder, the scalpel blade has slashed and separated close communities of tissues, rupturing long-established networks of blood vessels. After the operation, broken and cut tissues are crushed together by the surgeon's crude clamps. There's no circulation of blood or lymph across the suture. Yet, within seconds of the assault, the single cells are stirred into action. They use unimaginable senses to detect what has happened and start to respond. Stem cells specialize to become the spiky-looking cells of the stratum spinosum. The shattered capillaries are meticulously repaired. New cells form layers of smooth muscle. In the blood vessel walls, a neat endothelium. Nerve fibers extend towards the site of the suture to restore the tactile senses. These phenomena require individual cells to work out what they need to do, and the ingenious restoration of the blood vessel network reveals that there is an overarching sense of the structure of the whole area in which this remarkable repair takes place. So too does the restoration of the skin. Cells that carry out the repair are subtly coordinated so that the skin's surface, the contour of which they cannot surely detect, is restored in a form that is close to perfect. Unquote. It's not being radical to point out that we can't even begin to picture the unfathomable movement of trillions of molecules and millions of cells in the damaged area. The story is directed towards a desirable conclusion that you and I know very well: restoration to normalcy of a damaged body part. But how does the story hold together at the level of molecules and cells, which certainly do not know what we know, and yet, quite obviously, in some objective sense, the necessary knowledge is there in the organism. It knows, it gets the job done. Distinguishing this form of knowing from our own is an important task for the biologist. There can be no thought of our sort of consciousness in the cell, or in the crab, lizard, mouse, or redwood, and yet there clearly is a form of knowledgeable behaviour in the cell. This may carry some readers back to the mysterious remark we heard from Owen Barfield: asking about the origin of language is like asking about the origin of origin. The thought suggests that the meaningful language of things is the foundation of their existence. Tangentially speaking, it would be well for biologists to pull back a little from the religious wars and realize that the truly fundamental problem most people have with much of the biological and evolutionary literature is rather simple and needs respectful addressing. We read accounts of the organism, such as those just given, stories whose meaningful intricacies and coherent, eloquent plot lines never cease to surprise us, far outshining the highest literary achievements of a Shakespeare or Goethe or Pushkin. And then we hear that all this meaningful activity is somehow meaningless, or a product of meaninglessness. This, I believe, is the real issue troubling the majority of the American populace when they're asked about their belief in evolution. They see one thing, and then are told, more or less directly, that they're really seeing its denial. Yet no one has ever explained to them how you get meaning from meaninglessness. A difficult enough task once you realize that we cannot articulate any knowledge of the world at all except in the language of meaning. I see no reason why the issue of meaning couldn't become common ground for reasoned conversation between intelligent design advocates, who, after all, believe in the centrality of the logos, and conventional evolutionary theorists, who commonly grant that natural selection produces at least the appearance of meaning in the world, as well as the rest of us. Taking this meaning seriously and introducing some ways of thinking about it is what I've attempted here. It doesn't seem ignoble to set out on such a task, however much our views, our meanings, may differ. Taking responsibility for our knowledge. To reconcile ourselves to the full range of meanings we confront in our encounters with living beings is to transform our understanding of life. We discover that our highest capacities, our thinking, our formulation of goals and plans, our strivings and passions, our sense of well-being and illness, are objectively imaged in our own biological organism, right down to the molecular activity of our cells, as also in the cells of every other living creature. Where molecular biology once taught us that life is more about the interplay of molecules than we might have previously imagined, writes biologist and philosopher Lenny Moss, molecular biology is now beginning to reveal the extent to which macromolecules, with their surprisingly flexible and adaptive complex behavior, turn out to be more lifelike than we had previously imagined. But, as we have seen, it's hardly just a matter of macromolecules. It's the entire dynamic society of molecules, membranes, and organelles, with all their diverse conversations coordinated from above, that tells us we're looking at the logos of life, even at the molecular and cellular level. The supposed taking down we humans endured when we were made conscious of the apes should actually have been reorganized as a rebirth of the old conviction that we are the microcosms of the macrocosm. That man, as Ralph Waldo Emerson perceived, is placed at the center of beings and a ray of relation passes from every other being to him. We are cousins of all creatures, for in us the reason displayed in every creature flashes forth as conscious understanding, and just as, among humans, to be understood is fully as important as to understand, so too, our understanding of ape and honeybee and rainforest is today proving decisive for their own being. We have arrived at a time when we can say, consistent with the evolution of a threatened earth, every creature needs our understanding. We can, of course, hold back from that understanding. We can refuse, out of 19th century philosophical prejudice, to bring all our inner resources to bear, in order to establish the bonds of sympathy without which a rich, manifold understanding of our fellow creatures is impossible. But our world is one world, and we stand in a unique position within it. This position is not altogether unlike that of the mythical first Adam, who was given the insight to name his animal companions appropriately, according to their true nature. Doing so, we can assume, more in a dreamlike state than in anything approaching a modern, wide-awake, scientific consciousness. In our own scientifically informed way, we too can now discover what it means, both for us and for our earthly relatives, to know them with an open heart and a well-intentioned, selfless spirit. Particularly since that's more open-ended than our usual material, I'd invite you to contribute your thoughts. What did you make of Steve Talbot's perspectives there? You can add them online to the discussion at unwelcomeguest.net/608. And now we're going to mix the familiar and the unfamiliar. The book, The Underground History of American Education, was read on the show over the course of about a year by Lynn Gerry, but she didn't include this chapter on John Taylor Gatto's boyhood. Or perhaps it's because I'm a teacher, I do a lot of reflection on how my childhood influenced who I am today, and especially the positive contributions made by neighbours and others with whom I came into contact. So this, too, is not our normal material, but I hope you find it adds to your understanding of what Talbot is saying about the tapestry of meaning in which we thread our lives. Chapter 10. My Green River. John Taylor Gatto starts this chapter with a quote from Robert Batchon. Every person in a village has a face and a name, even a nickname. Anonymity is impossible, for the villagers are not a mass,
The village has its own language, its customs, its rhythms. Its life is interior. A village cannot be global. Before I went to first grade, I could add, subtract, and multiply in my head. I knew my times tables, not as work, but as games Dad played on drives around Pittsburgh. Learning anything was easy, when you felt like it. My father taught me that, not any school. When I went to first grade, I could read fluently. I loved to read grown-up books I selected from the three-level, glass-enclosed bookcase behind the front door in Swissvale. It held hundreds. I knew if I kept reading, things would eventually come. Mother taught me that, and she was right. I remember taking down the Decameron time after time, only to find its deceptively simple language concealing meanings I couldn't fathom. Each time I put the book back, I made a mental note to try again next month. And sure enough, one month it happened. I was 10. My father was a cookie salesman. Mother called him that anyway when she was angry, which was often. He'd gone to work as a teenager to help support the widowed grandmother and to help his brother Frank, the smart one, through the University of Pittsburgh. Dad never got to college, but he was a genius just the same. Mother went for 1 year. She was a genius, too. They were the kind of people who exposed the malice of bell curves and rankings for what it is. I miss them both, and think of them often with love and gratitude. Mother I called Booty, most of the time, because that's what I heard her own mother say. Booty read fairy tales to me in the cradle. She recited poems. She filled my ears and eyes with language, even though she had little else in the way of things to give. One day she bought a set of encyclopedias from a door-to-door salesman that cost more than we could afford. I know because she and Dad fought when we got home. From then on, Mother read the encyclopedia every day. We read all the newspapers, too. In those days, they only cost a couple of cents. I liked the Hearst Sun-Telegraph best because it used violent layouts, and on the upper corner of the Sunday edition, a little boy called Puck, dressed like a fop, said in a speech balloon, "What fools these mortals be!" I don't know what he meant, but I said the words out loud to punctuate adult conversation and always got a smile when I did. As far as I can figure, any success I had as a schoolteacher came from what my mother, my father, my sister, my family, friends, and town taught, not from a single thing I can remember about Cornell and Columbia, my two colleges. Not from any findings of institutes of child study or directives from departments of education. If I'm correct, then this insight is more significant than it may appear. The immense edifice of teacher instruction and schooling in general rests on the shaky hypothesis that expert intervention in childhood produces better people than might otherwise occur. I've come to doubt that. A gigantic social investment rides on this hypothesis. One that might otherwise be spent on reducing stress on family life, which interferes with happiness and the growth of intelligence. Had the small fortune spent on my own schooling been invested instead in my people and my place directly, I have a hunch I would have turned out better. Whatever the truth of this complex proposition, as long as you've spent your money and time to hear what I have to say, you have a right to know something about the fountainhead of my schoolteaching practice. My growing up time on the Green River, Monongahela. I feel grateful for the luck to have been born in a tiny city with the character of a village on the River Monongahela in western Pennsylvania. People cared for each other there. Even the town wastrels had a history, but we minded our own business in Mon City, too. Both are important. Everyone seemed to understand that within broad limits there is no one best way to grow up. Rich or poor doesn't matter much if you know what's important. Poverty can't make you miserable. Only a bad character and a weak spirit can do that. In Monongahela, people seem to know that children have a remarkable power to survive unfavorable environments, as long as they have a part in a vital community. In the years I grew up, in the place I grew up, tales of social workers breaking up families, in the best interests of the child, weren't common, although on several occasions I heard Uncle Bud threaten to punch out this man's lights or that one's if the person didn't start treating his wife better, or his kids. Bud was always punching someone in the interest of justice. Over the years, any number of students found a way to tell me that what they appreciated most about my classes was that I didn't waste their time. I think I learned how not to do that through a good bit of luck, being born in Monongahela during the Depression, when money was tight and people were forced to continue older traditions of making their own meanings instead of buying them. And they learned how many very different ways there were to grow strong. What the vast industry of professional child-rearing has told you about the right way to grow up matters less than you've been led to believe. Until you know that, you remain caught like a fly in the web of the great therapeutic community of modern life. That will make you sick quicker than anything. I went Christmas caroling long before I knew how to read, or even what Christmas was about. I was 3. The carolers stood on a corner diagonally across from my grandfather's printing office, where their voices filled an informal amphitheatre made by the slope of Second Street just before it met Main, the principal intersection of the town. If I had to guess where I learnt to love rhythmical language, it would be on that corner at the foot of Second Street Hill. In Monongahela, I fished for carp and catfish made inedible by river acids leaching out of the mines and waste put there by the mills. I fished them out with homemade dough balls, whipped together in Grandmother Mossy's kitchen. In Monongahela, I waited weekly for the changing of Binks McGregor's haberdashery window or Bill Pulaski's hardware display as eagerly as a theatre-goer might wait to be refreshed by a new scenery change. Mother's family, the Zimmers, and the branch of Gattos my father represented were poor by modern big city standards, but not really poor for that time and place. It was only in late middle age I suddenly realized that sleeping 3 to a bed, as mother, sister, and I did, is almost an operational definition of poverty, or its close cousin, but it never occurred to me to think of myself as poor, not once, not ever. Even later on at Uniontown High School, when we moved to a town with sharp social class gradations and a formal social calendar, I had little awareness of any unbridgeable gulf between myself and those people who invited me to country club parties and to homes grander than my own. Nor, do I believe, did they. A year at Cornell, however, made certain my innocence would come to an end. Mother was not so lucky. Although she never spoke openly of it, I know now she was ashamed of having less than those she grew up with. Once she had much more before Pappy, my granddad, was wiped out in the 1929 crash. She wasn't envious, mind you, she was ashamed, and this shame constrained her open nature. It made her sad and wistful when she was alone. It caused her to hide away from former friends and the world. She yearned for dignity, for the days when her clothes were made in Paris. So, in the calculus of human misery, she exercised her frustration on Dad. Their many separations and his long absences from home on business, even when they lived together, are likely to have originated in this immaculate tension. The great irony is that Mother did beautifully without money. She was resourceful, imaginative, generally optimistic, a woman with greater power to create something from nothing, totem poles from thread spools, an award-winning Halloween costume from scrap paper and cloth, a high-quality adventure from a simple walk through the hills, than anyone. She had no extravagant appetites, didn't drink, didn't crave exotic food, glamorous places, or the latest gadgets. She set her own hair, and it was always lovely. She kept the cleanest house imaginable, full of pretty objects which she gathered watchfully and with superb taste on her journey through life. As if to compound the irony of her discontent, Mon City was hardly a place to be rich. There wasn't much to buy there. I shouldn't say nobody had money in Monongahela, but it's accurate to say nothing was expensive. Beer was the town passion, more a religion with the men, and a big glass cost only a nickel, the same price as 12 ounces of buttermilk or a candy bar 3 times heavier than the modern sort. Bones to make soup were free. Beyond movies, 12 cents for kids, commercial entertainment hardly existed. There were a few bowling alleys at a nickel a frame, Red's Beach, a pool at least 10 miles away where swimming was a dime, and a roller-skating rink that I never went to. Where society thrived was in hundreds of ethnic social clubs and fraternal organizations up and down the valley. The Moose, the Elks, the Odd Fellows, Mystic Knights, Sons of Slovenia, the Polish-American Society, the Russian-American Club. These were places for men to drink and talk cheaply, except on Saturday night, when ladies could drink and talk too, alongside their men, and have a dance, sometimes with even a live band to give the snap to the joint. No kid in Mon City reached for the Events and Archives page of the papers, because there wasn't one, nor were there any special kid places that people of all ages didn't frequent. When the men weren't playing bocce at the Italian club, kids were allowed, passing first through a bar room reeking of unpasteurized stale beer. No special life was arranged for kids, yet there was always a full menu. Just spying on the adult world, watching people work, setting out on expeditions to explore, filled whatever time you wanted to spare. Until I got to Cornell, I can't recall anyone I ever knew saying, "I'm bored." And yet, in New York City, when I moved there, hardly a day passed without someone crying loud and long about ennui. Perhaps this indicates some more important marker we've missed in our modern search to make private worlds for children. The constituents of meaning have been stripped away from these over-specialized places. Why a child would want to associate exclusively with children in a narrow age or social class range defies understanding. That adults would impose such a fate on kids strikes me as an act of madness. The greatest fun was watching work at construction sites, watching freight trains unload or coal up, studying lumber yards at work, seeing gas pumped, hoods lifted, metal welded, tires vulcanized, watching Johnny Nami cut hair, watching Vito fill chocolates. Best of all was watching Charlie Biggerton, the cop, on his rounds without his catching on. When kids around town pooled data about Charlie, we could recreate the police patrol schedule accurately enough that violating wartime curfew was like taking candy from a baby. At 213 Second Street, we lived over the printing office Grandad owned, the Zimmer Printing Company. Since 1898, his swinging sign read, it was located only a block and a half from the Green River, west of the streetcar tracks on Main. In between river and streetcars were the Pennsylvania Railroad right-of-way and tracks, which followed the river down to Pittsburgh. Our second-floor bay window hung over the town's main intersection, where trolleys from Charlevoix and Donora pass constantly, clanging and hissing, all lit up in the dark night. An incredible vision, these things, orange metal animals, with people in their stomachs, throwing illuminated reflections in color onto the ceiling of our living room by an optical process I often thought to have explained to me, but never did. Bright sparks flew from their wheels and fell from the air around the overhead power lines, burning sharp holes in dark places. From our perch we could also see the long freight trains roaring along the river, sending an orchestra of clanks and whistle shrieks into the sky. We could watch great paddle-wheel steamers plying the river in both directions, filling the air with columns of white steam. From early till late, Grandmother Mossy sat rocking. She sat at the window facing the river, quietly observing this mechanical show of riverboat, train, and steam car, 4 tiers of movement, if you count the steam of auto traffic, 5 if you include the pedestrians, our neighbours, flowing north and south on Main, far into the night hours. She seldom ventured to the street from our apartment, after her great disgrace of 15 years earlier, when lack of money forced her to move abruptly one day from a large home with marble fireplaces. She never spoke to my grandfather, not a word, after that, though they ate 2 meals a day at the same small table. The telephone supplied sufficient new data about neighbours, enough so she could chart the transit of the civilization she had once known face to face. Sitting with Moss in the darkness was always magic. Keeping track of the mechanisms out there, each with its own personality, rolling and gliding, this way or that, on mysterious errands, watching Grandmother smoke Chesterfield after Chesterfield, with which she would write glowing words in the air for me to read, beginning with my name, Jackie. Seen that way, words became exciting. I couldn't get enough of them. Imagine the two of us sitting there year after year, never holding a recognizable conversation, yet never tiring of each other's company. Sometimes Moss would ask me to find numbers in the inspired graphics of an eccentric comic strip, Toonerville Trolley, so she could gamble 2 cents with the barber across the street who ran numbers in the intervals between clipping his customer's hair. Although we really didn't hold conversation in any customary fashion, Moss would comment out loud on a wide range of matters, often making allusions beyond my ken. Was she speaking to herself? I would react or not. Sometimes I asked a question. After a smoke-filled interval, she might answer. Sometimes she would teach me nonsense riddles like, "A titimus, a tatimus, it took 2 T's to tie 2 T's to 2 small trees. How many T's are there in that?" Or tongue-twisters like "rubber baby buggy bumpers" or "she sells seashells by the seashore," which I was supposed to say 10 times in a row as fast as I could. Sometimes these were verses that would sound ugly to modern ears, as in "God made a nigger, he made him in the night, God made a nigger but forgot to make him white." Yet I have good reason to believe Moss never actually met or spoke with a black person in her entire life, or harbored any ill will toward one. It was just a word game, its only significance wordplay. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. On the subject of race, we all learned to sing about black people, officially, in 3rd grade. Darktown Strutter's Ball, Old Black Joe, and others. No distinction of race preceded or followed. They were just songs. Before you conclude my memories are daft and that Mon City must be a bigoted place, you need to know its tiny population contained the broadest diversity of ethnic groups living together in harmony. 90 years earlier, it had been a regular stop on the Underground Railroad. The barn of the Annawalt House was used for that purpose all through the 1850s. If Vico's notion in The New Science is correct, we encounter the world in ways first implicit in ourselves. There can be no filling of black slates in education, no pouring of wisdom into empty children. If Vico is correct, the Monongahela I bring dripping to you from the bottom of my river memory is a private city, revealing the interior of my own mind. Whether you believe that the fall is real or only a metaphor for the feeling we get when by losing our way home we find ourselves cut off from the creative source, who I am and why I taught the way I did is long ago and far away in that town, those people, that green river, not in any course of scientific pedagogy. The great destructive myth of the 20th century was the aggressive contention that a child couldn't grow up correctly in the unique circumstances of his own family. In order to avoid having you finish this essay with the feeling that it might have been all right for my family to influence my growth so intensely, but for many children with worse families that just wouldn't do, fix your attention a minute on the less savoury aspects of my people, as they might be seen through social service eyes. Both sets of grandparents and my mother and father were seriously alienated from one another, the men from the women, and vice versa. On the Zimmer side, heavy drinking and German and Irish tempers led to one violent conflict after another, conflicts to which my sister and I were fully exposed. We grew like weeds as children, with full run of the town, including its most dangerous places, had no effective curfew, and tended to excess in everything. Did I forget to mention the constant profanity? By up-to-the-minute big city standards, my family skirted the boundary of court-ordered family dissolution more than once. Since a substantial number of the families I worked with productively as a schoolteacher had rap sheets similar to my own by social hygiene standards, I want to offer you my Monongahela years as a case study of how a less-than-ideal family by social work standards can still teach courage, love, duty, self-reliance, can awaken curiosity and wonder, can be a laboratory for independent thought, well-rooted identity, and communitarian feelings, and can grow in memory as a beloved companion even when it is composed of ghosts. The city of Monongahela itself is offered as a case study of a different sort, showing the power of common places to return loyalty by animating the tiniest details of existence. The town is a main character in my personal story, a genius loci interlacing with my development as a schoolteacher. I invested an extreme amount of effort in the physical presence of my classrooms, I think, because the physical presence of my town never left me even after I was far removed from it. I wanted that same sort of ally for my kids. Derek Snyder once said, quote, "Of all memberships we identify ourselves by, the one most forgotten that has greatest potential for healing is place." The quiet rage I felt at bearing the last name of a then socially devalued minority, the multiple grievances I felt off and on against my parents for being a house divided, at my sister for making herself a stranger to me, at my dad for staying away so I grew up with only a distant acquaintanceship between us, the bewilderment I felt from having to sit nightly at dinner with grandparents who hadn't spoken to one another for 15 years, and for whom I was required to act as go-between, the compounding of this bewilderment when I discovered my Italian grandfather had been buried in an unmarked grave, perhaps for taking a mistress, the utter divide geographically and culturally between mother's family and father's, the fantastic gulf between the expressive idiom of the Germans, who treated rage and violence as if they were normal, and dad's people, the quintessence of decorous rationality, the absolute inability of mother to face the full demands of her maturity, yet her inspiring courage when principles were challenged, all of these made for an exciting, troubled, and even dangerous childhood. Would I have been better off in foster care, do you think? Are others? Are you insane? What allowed me to make sense of things against the kaleidoscope of these personal dynamics was that town and its river, the two constants I depended upon. They were enough. I survived, even came to thrive, because of my membership in Monongahela, the irreducible, unclassifiable, asystematic village of my boyhood, so different from the neo-villages of social work. All the town's denizens played a part. The iridescent river dragonflies, the burbling streetcars, the prehistoric freight trains, the grandeur of the paddle-wheel boats, the unpackaged cookies and uncut in advance of purchased cheese and meat, women in faded cotton house dresses who carried themselves with bearing and dignity in spite of everything, men who swore constantly and spit huge green and yellow globs of phlegm on the sidewalks, steel workers who took every insult as mortal and mussed a little boy's hair because he was Zim's nephew. I hung around a lot in Monongahela, looking at things and people, trying them on for size. Much is learned by being lazy. I learned to fish that way, to defend myself, to take risks by going down in the abandoned coal mine across the river full of strange machinery and black water, a primitive world with nobody around me to tell me to be careful. I learned to take knocks without running away, to watch hard men and women reveal themselves through their choices. I cleaned Pappy's printing office daily, after closing, for a silver St. Gordon's Walking Goddess Liberty 50-cent piece, the most beautiful American coin ever made. I sold some telegraphs and post-gazettes on the corner of 2nd and Main for a profit of a penny a paper. I had a Kool-Aid stand on Main and 4th on hot summer days. Shouldn't you ask why your boy or girl needs to know anything about Iraq or about computer language before they can tell you the name of every tree, plant, and bird outside your window? What will happen to them with their high standardized test scores when they discover they can't fry an egg, sew a button, join things, build a house, sail a boat, ride a horse, gut a fish, pound a nail, or bring forth life and nurture it? Do you believe having those things done for you is the same? You fool, then. Why do you cooperate in the game of compulsion schooling when it makes children useless to themselves as adults, hardly able to tie their own shoes? I learned to enjoy my own company in Monongahela, to feel at ease with anyone, to put my trust in personal qualities rather than statistical gradations. Anything else? Well, I learned to love there. Just across the river bridge and over the river hill was open farm country, and anyone could walk there in 30 minutes. Everyone was welcome, kids included. The farmers never complained. Mother would walk Joni and me there in the early morning as mist was rising from the river. When she was 72, I wrote to her trying to explain what I'm trying to explain now, how her town had given me underpinnings to erect a life upon. Dear Mum, I think what finally straightened me out was the memory of those early morning walks you used to take me up River Hill, with mist rising from the green river and trees, the open pits of abandoned coal mines producing their own kind of strange beauty in the soft silence of the new day. Coming out of the grit and rust of Monongahela, crossing the clean architecture of the old bridge with its dizzy view to the river below, through the wide-set slats underfoot, that was a worthy introduction to the hills on the far shore. Going up those hills with you, we startled many a rabbit to flight. I know you remember that, too. I was amazed that wild things lived so close to the town. Then at the top, we could see Monongahela in the valley the way birds must. But when we turned away, everything was barns and cornland. You gave me our town. It was the best gift. My best teachers in Monongahela were Frank Pitsiga, the high-rolling car dealer, old Mr. Marcus, the druggist wiser than a doctor, Binks McGregor, psychological haberdasher, and Bill Pulaski, the fun-loving mayor. All would understand my belief that we need to be hiring different kinds of people to teach us, people who've proven themselves in life by bearing its pain like free spirits. Nobody should be allowed to teach until they get to be 40 years old. No one should be allowed anywhere near kids without having known grief, challenge, success, failure, and sadness. We ought to be asking men and women who've raised families to teach, older men and women who know the way things are and why.
And that's where we leave John Taylor Gatto. The rest of that chapter is available online from our audiobooks page. Now this and all previous episodes are available from our MP3 archive. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope you have enjoyed this philosophical start to my third year of shows, and that it will help you make sense of the world, and who knows, to express your love of all life, near and far. Just like